splashing in the ocean, I'm losing control.
Hello and welcome back to the Vacation Bible School podcast. My name is Jason Kirk, joined by Emily Kirk. Hello, Emily. How are you today?
Hey, I'm good, thanks. How you doing?
Good enough, I guess. Good enough is the goal. Here on VBS, we are working our way through the entire Bible, story by story and book by book. We have made our way about halfway through the book of Exodus, the second book. It's taken us months to get this far.
You're in for a long, bumpy ride.
But we're having fun, and we are discovering as we go that each story is better and weirder and deeper than we were led to believe as kids, than we learned in Sunday school, than we learned in big church, than we learned in the cartoons and the storybooks and so forth that we were given. His kids.
As fantastical as everything was growing up, like the way that stories are told and magic is real and all of that, it's actually way more fun doing it this way than learning about it that way.
That general working thesis that we have to this point fits really well with this episode. The Red Sea, the parting of the Red Sea, as the Israelites led by Moses have just escaped Egypt after the plagues battered the Pharaoh's resistance down to nothing, and God kept refortifying the Pharaoh's resistance just so God could humiliate the Pharaoh
further
and
further.
The Israelites are now on the move, and the most epic image in the entire Hebrew Bible is just a chapter or two away. Emily, what did we learn about this story as kids?
That there were giant walls of water with lots and lots of fish and whales and everything swimming around as these people marched through, and that it was just epic moment of walls of water and Moses standing there with his arms stretched out. That's the image I have in my mind.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it obviously is informed because there was a very famous movie released in the 1950s that is like 4 or 5 hours long. The Ten Commandments, Charlton Heston. I'm not going to watch the 4 hour Justice League movie. I'm not going to watch a 1950s movie that's 4 hours long, but it influenced the culture and it's almost impossible. Prince of Egypt gave you the same image. I'm certain there's some Simpsons episode that gives you the exact same image of massive towering walls of water, and that's about it. That's about all that we really talk about all that often. I don't remember growing up as a Christian kid it being discussed as like, maybe there's no super clear Jesus reference stuff. Maybe there is like, you know, oh, it was kind of like you go down into the earth and you come back out, just like Jesus. You know, you go down into the belly of the sea and you come back out. See, resurrection. All right, move along. Let's talk about Colossians some more.
I don't even remember actually why they were going through the parted seas being as important as the fact that the seas were parted, which is also kind of backwards.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, oh, look how cool God is.
Yeah.
This was a part of the Bible that we, as younger Christian persons, kind of only dealt with in terms of like storybook and not like a story in the book, as like a connection between Genesis to the Exodus to this, to what is next, to what the Israelites do next, to the rest of the Hebrew Bible, and so on and so forth. It was just kind of like this thing from the, you know, old part of the Bible that we only kind of talk about when it relates directly to Jesus.
Or when there's something really cool happens.
Which is the stuff they never wanted us to know about. And that's what this podcast is for. So, Exodus 13, first day out of Egypt since Genesis 47, 430 years earlier. God tells Moses, who has now become a very confident public speaker, remember, of course, in Genesis 4 when God and Moses first meet, Moses lacks confidence in perhaps not just his communication style, but with his ability to relate to the Israelites. He doesn't think they will listen to a person who was raised with a whole different faith, who can pass as Egyptian, who has power in this, you know, what they perceive to be an evil society.
I don't really know that Moses even knew how to relate to these people other than now knowing his where he comes from. I think that was not just the Israelites being able to relate to Moses, but how does he relate to them when he grew up in privilege and they grew up as slaves?
Yeah. So now here we are. Now that the plagues worked, the Israelites are free, and Moses has gone from that to confident enough to give a speech directed by God about how, here's the first thing we're going to talk about, seeing as it's just been the night of Passover, how important Israel's firstborn males are. Note, Genesis spent all of its time undermining this before Exodus had even established it. Also, back in Genesis, firstborns really did matter, like, in a way. Like, Judah was the top non-criminal son of Jacob, at least as far as Jacob knew. Jacob basically tied Esau as the firstborn, and then somewhere between 50% and 100% of his immediate family agreed to switch the Jacob-Esau birth order. Isaac was the first full son of Abraham. Abraham was a firstborn, going back to Shem, who was the firstborn son of Noah. So, like, even though Genesis spent all of its time messing with the trope of the firstborn, at this point in Exodus, you can look back and say, like, okay, it didn't, like, abolish it. And it always gave a reason why the second or fourth, however many, son was treated like the firstborn. So, now God has finally got all his people back, more people than he's ever had before. Last he saw these folks, as far as we knew, it was 70 people, and now it is thousands. God's picking a route home to Canaan, because that was the deal. That was the deal he made Abraham. He said, Abraham, you follow me, and I will give you a great nation in the land of Canaan. It's going to take about 400 years. Well, it's been about 400 years, so it's time to pay up.
It's like an instant thing. It's not like a journey, necessarily. It was just like, oh, it's been 400 years. It's time.
You can almost hear like a timer going off, right? Like this is an alarm clock, and God's right. Like, oh, you know, waking up on Mount Sinai. Oh, I gotta go pick the kids up. He's leading the Israelites as a pillar of fire at night, a pillar of cloud by day, an embodiment of the plagues of darkness and hailfire that just hammered Egypt. Not only is God so badass that he will blast Egypt from above, that same badass thunder fire will lead you home to Canaan. God and the Israelites, they've kind of just met. In a generational way, these people have been together for hundreds and hundreds of years. God and Moses know each other very well. God and the Israelites, this is still kind of a brand new thing. God is worried that he might have a mutiny if he leads them directly into trouble. So God takes them on a little bit of a long way. He avoids the route along the Mediterranean Sea because of the Philistines. Anybody with any familiarity with the Bible has heard of the Philistines. Goliath was a Philistine. They will be one of the main enemies for the rest of the Hebrew Bible once the Israelites finally do make it to Canaan. Spoiler alert. So the Philistines, in the time of Ramesses, which is when this story likely would have been kind of set, they might have been one of the sea peoples, pirates, who'd been at war with Egypt in real life. And they might have been the people the Egyptians settled along the Canaanite shore to begin with. Though, this would kind of be messing with our timelines because that wouldn't be exactly the same as when the Bible story was happening. In Genesis, this is also the people of King Abimelech, who were constantly duped by Abraham's sister-wife trick, even though, again, that's probably, if you're going with the real timeline, that would have been very different people. Anyway, timelines are messed up. That part kind of doesn't matter a whole lot. It's better to think of this as literary foreshadowing than it is as hard history, because the point is, there are Philistines there, they will be enemies, and God isn't ready to trust his bond with the Israelites enough to take them on just yet. So they're going to go south, a little bit south. It doesn't say how far south. They're going to go toward a thing that we think of as the Red Sea. Exodus 14, God tells Moses to lead the Israelites to a specific camp by the water. And it sucks there. The Israelites are telling Moses he should have just left them in Egypt. Moses, the guy who had no confidence in his ability to speak to the Israelites, now he not only speaks to them, not only calms them, he sees through their statements and into their hearts, and he finds the thing that is actually troubling them. He tells them not to be scared. They're scared.
And I think this is further proof that just shows, like, the Israelites, they're still not familiar with God. They still don't totally trust God. They've seen him obliterate the Egyptians, but they probably have some thought in their head because they're not familiar with him. Like, are we next?
Sure. I mean, if you've never seen this guy actually, like, protect, you know, anyone or like, create or conserve, if all you've seen him do is blow stuff up.
And he protected them the first time around, but, I mean, who's to say that won't change? I mean, we have the knowledge of, we have history to look back on and know that, okay, they weren't destroyed, but they didn't have that information at the time.
Sure, if all you know of this God is he rains fire and blood and stuff. All right, hey, Moses, buddy, what'd you get us into here?
We'd rather be slaves.
Yeah, they do say that at least a couple of points, and Moses perceives it as well, that like wandering in the middle of the desert kind of aimlessly between enemies, food and water are kind of scarce. At times, they do say, you should have just left us in Egypt. So, the Red Sea. When we say south, How far south are we talking? I think this is going to get us to the first of 10 things that I kind of want to describe as misconceptions about the Red Sea story. The first is that the Red Sea is the Red Sea. So kind of a big one there. Look at a map of Egypt if you can, or pull one up in your mind. The Israelites are walking from Goshen, north of Cairo, the northern delta region of Egypt. That means they're really far north of the thing on our modern map labeled the Red Sea, the big body of water between Africa and Arabia. Why would they go that far south just to avoid some people who lived along the Mediterranean coast? Here's the thing. We have no idea which body of water is actually being referred to in the Bible when it says the thing that has been translated as the Red Sea. The name the Bible uses a couple dozen times from Exodus through Nehemiah can translate to Sea of Reeds. Sometimes later on, this is specifically referring to the thing on our map called the Red Sea. Here, not necessarily. At least 1,000 years ago, Jewish scholars started realizing Exodus's Sea of Reeds is not necessarily the world map's Red Sea. So, since it's unlikely that it's the Red Sea itself, let's scroll up the map a little bit to the Gulf of Suez, for starters. That skinnier body of water between Africa and the Sinai Peninsula. It's about a tenth as deep and a tenth as wide as the Red Sea. The Gulf of Suez would be much closer to a feasible path and require much less of a miracle to cross, though it'd still take something really special. So if, you know, approaching the story of the crossing of the Red Sea is, oh my gosh, that's so far-fetched, and how in the world did these old people think anyone would buy that story? Well, if they're not talking about the Red Sea because they were describing it as the Sea of Reeds, then we're talking about a smaller body of water. So even if things are still sounding fantastical, they're still sounding a little bit more realistic already, because maybe it's the Gulf of Suez. Here's another, I think, it might not be a misconception, but I think it's a thing that's a little bit more fluid than it's often described as. 10 plagues. The 10 plagues that God rained down on the Egyptians. Frogs, locusts, boils, gnats, blood, firstborn, all that. The Bible doesn't say, and here was the first plague, and here was the second plague, and here was the 10th. All done. You can make the case that what happens at the Red Sea is yet another plague. Exodus 14:2. God says, "Hey, Moses, let's act like we're lost. Camp by the water, because I have one more trick. I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart one last time."
Again.
Yeah. And like every time we've heard God say this before, he has been referring to a plague. So why would this not count as a plague? God starved his country, butchered his children, broke him over and over. Deserved, by the way, at least in terms of Pharaoh's suffering. Now God's going to run up the score one last time. "I will gain glory for myself over Pharaoh and all his army." This is how he described all the plagues, and it's how he describes the Red Sea.
This is like the final punch to get the Egyptians, not just to stick it to Pharaoh, but to get the Egyptians to be like, "Oh, that is the God."
Yeah, and right around here, it really does say, like, this is the last time we will ever have to deal with the Egyptians as an empire, which is kind of fantastical because the Egyptian empire continued for some time. But the point of this was, there's a little bit more glory God can squeeze out of this. This can be an example for an even longer amount of time, not just to the Egyptians, but to everybody.
And it's showing the Israelites yet again that, like, no, I'm doing this to the Egyptians, not to you.
Yeah. So God is going to set up a camp. And it really is written like setting up an ambush. God is setting up a camp, and he's like really positioning them. He's like, no, let's scoot back a little bit. Right there. Hold right there. And then God goes and jumps into Pharaoh's brain or whatever, because we're immediately getting a report of what the Pharaoh is thinking. And the Pharaoh thinks in like poetry. He doesn't, the way it's written in the Bible, when everyone else is talking, you know, it's just written as like, even God is talking, it's just written as like a sentence of dialogue within the narrative. But when Pharaoh is thinking, it's like this, it's broken out as like glorious poetry. It's almost like God is mocking the Pharaoh, thinking of himself as important. So Pharaoh starts to realize the Israelites are confounded in the land with wilderness closed all around them. Pharaoh thinks the Israelites are pinned against water with no way out. Pharaoh thinks Moses is out of magic tricks. Pharaoh thinks, now's my chance to revenge and reconquest and take back all my enslaved people and all the gold and silver they took with them as well.
I still get confused at this, though, because if we're going based on the numbers in the Bible, they are still far outnumbered. They brought 600 of their best chariots and all the other ones, too. That was funny that it was broken up that way to me, because if they brought all of them, then just say they brought all their chariots. But why follow them when you know that you're outnumbered? What were you going to do? How are you going to bring back these 600,000 people with you with 600 chariots?
Yeah, Bible math, once again.
Right.
But like, Pharaoh does not have the numbers to pull this off,
What were they going to do when they, we gotcha now.
Yeah.
And then what?
Well, that's what happens when God hardens your heart. I think anytime I do anything stupid for the rest of my life, I'm just going to say, well, I guess God hardened my heart.
But, like, did they bring handcuffs? Did they bring chains? Like, how would they have physically done it if they say that it had worked? Say Pharaoh's plan worked.
I think they're just going to do an incredible, like, horse-pony show, you know? And just like, oh, this is...
awesome. Let's go join the circus.
Like, hooray, it's a circus. There might have been, like, a Wild West kind of thing. Lassoing. I don't know. So, speaking of, misconception number 3. A thing we have addressed in a couple episodes now, including the first Exodus episode we did titled Moses something or other. Millions and millions of people are crossing the Red Sea, and many hundreds of thousands are dying, and it's this gigantic, massive conflict. As we know, according to Bible math, it wasn't actually a 600,000-man army that Moses possesses. It might have been more like 6,000. The word in the Hebrew is kind of similar to something like a whole bunch. Moses had like X number of whole bunches. And that can get translated in a whole bunch of ways. So here comes Pharaoh taking the bait with hundreds of chariot warriors. Moses' army is scared, which that indicates it's probably not 600,000 guys. So taking the size of the Red Sea down from just, quote, the Red Sea to a smaller sea like the Gulf of Suez, and taking the size of Moses' populace down from 2.5 million to maybe like 25,000. We've made this story already, just with those two tweaks, like 100 times more plausible than the typical Hollywood vision of like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people crossing the ocean. Great start. So when God hardens the Pharaoh's heart this time, it's not just Pharaoh's heart. It is the entire Egyptian army's heart. God has hacked everything. God is installing this brain virus in the entire Egyptian army.
They're now robots against the Israelites.
They're just playthings of God's. He's just slamming his toys together. So the smoke pillar of God is concealing Moses. The shield Abraham doubted is the smoke pillar of God concealing Moses. Moses is raising his staff, his magic snake wand, and God's wind, the breath of the Spirit. Genesis 1, Genesis 8, for the third time, the breath of God blows chaos water, the water of the lake, the water of the sea, the water of the creation void, down into dry land. The Israelites walk through two, there's the quote, walls of water.
Okay, so I think people tend to take this very literally when it says walls of water, but if you're thinking of it as a path, anything surrounding you could be considered a wall. It doesn't necessarily have to be tall, right? But also, waves can look like walls, and I'm sure that, you know, if he was had dried this up with the wind, that there are going to be waves on either side. And there's also things called sandbars, which can make things look a lot taller than they are, or more shallow, or maybe they were in between a sandbar where their water was dried up. So
sure, like a garden could have a wall, you know, like a little retainer wall.
Right, it doesn't have to be something so magnificent necessarily, because it's still pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, like, as a person who's like, all right, there is a version of this that, you know, there is possibly a real story, a real kernel of truth that this could be based on. Walls of water is the only thing that is kind of awkward to deal with, because, like, the image is so ingrained that we're talking about, like, 40-foot walls of water. So the Egyptians pursue into the mud. God clogs their wheels, so they're stuck in the middle of the sea. The Egyptians are repenting, which didn't work all that well for Pharaoh when he tried it like 7 or 8 times. The water comes crashing down. God doesn't just wait for the Egyptians to get caught in it. He hurls them into the waves that are impending. There go the Egyptians. The Egyptians are done. They are out. That's it. So right here we can remember God's paranoia about Adam and or Eve becoming immortal and thus becoming like God. His fear the Tower of Babel would rival heaven and the Noah flood, the thing that was all about people having too many half-divine babies. Now look what he's done to the Pharaoh demigod. That's 4 times now. Nothing infuriates God more than people becoming a little too much like God.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of doing this is to show the Israelites, the Egyptians, that he is the most powerful God. So he's literally telling you that that's his goal here.
Yeah, we see in Islam's holy text that the Pharaoh says, I am God. Pharaoh blasphemed to God's face, or at least the face of God's prophet Moses. So, speaking of prophecy, let's go back to God's first meeting with Moses on Mount Sinai, 11 chapters and 2 episodes ago. God told Moses he was putting together a crew. He was going to obliterate the Pharaoh, make Pharaoh beg for more punishment, free the Israelites, and the Egyptians would pay reparations on the way out. All of that came true. Exodus 4:9, way back on Mount Sinai when God was just a little burning bush of fire. God told Moses, "The water you take from the Nile will become blood." Moses himself, blood of the Israelites, was taken from the Nile water as a baby. Moses was taken from the water by Egypt and became Egyptian, if not Egyptian, by blood. Moses used God magic to turn the Nile water into blood. And now, Moses, Nile water baby, possibly named after water in both languages, is filling the seawater with the blood of the Nile's people. I don't even know how many ways God's Exodus 4:9 prophecy about water from blood came true, but we're going to count it because one of these is what he meant. Maybe all of them, maybe a whole bunch more. This, great job, God. You're really smart.
He just kept putting a period at the end of that sentence.
Misconception number 4. The sea was a sea. So the Gulf of Suez is still about 10 to 20 miles across, though there's a little gulf that's only like a half a mile. I spent a lot of time on Google Maps for this episode.
He really likes it.
Still, and like, that would take a really weird weather event to just like wipe a path through a mile of sea. The name Sea of Reeds, which is a more correct translation of the term that they're using in Exodus. That has led a lot of people to point out papyrus reeds, the plant Egyptians used to make paper. That plant grows alongside shallow marshes, not deep ocean salt water. If you Google paintings of Miriam and baby Moses in the Nile, you see people standing waist high in a deep creek, not a huge gulf. And like, no, Renaissance paintings of Bible stuff are not always the most scientifically accurate thing in the world, but that's a much better example. We're talking about a body of water that is far smaller and shallower than even the Gulf of Suez, let alone the Red Sea, which is part of the ocean. But we can go further, because further up what's now the Suez Canal is the Great Bitter Lake, not a sea, no more than 8 miles across, and right next to it is the Little Bitter Lake, only about a mile wide and 30 foot deep on average. Go a little bit further north, almost parallel from Goshen, where the Israelites were coming from, you have Lake Timsah, a smaller, shallower lake with marshy, reedy parts. Further north than that is Lake Manzala, a really shallow lagoon of the Mediterranean. There have probably been places and times you could walk people across this without an act of God. But if this is the one, then they would have had to make a really hard turn south to avoid the Philistines. There's one proposal: the Egyptians chased the Israelites all the way across Sinai, and they crossed on the other side, the Gulf of Aqaba, which is thinner than the Gulf of Suez and could have island hopping.
That sounds fun.
Once you accept we're not talking about crossing part of the ocean, you can find plenty of arguments about this or that land bridge or sandbar or thing that used to be a lake, or maybe there was a drought followed by a flash flood. If you want to lose your mind looking at like MS Paint maps and possibly become an Always Sunny in Philadelphia conspiracy meme guy, Google N-U-W-E-I-B-A beach. I had to look away after clicking through a few pages of it because I'm trying to save all the like galaxy brain energy for Revelation, but the point is, if the authors were referring to a specific body of water, and they might have been just using a loose term for a reedy lake in the area between Egypt and Israel, because all of this is beside the point. If they were referring to a specific body of water, it was one much, much shallower and narrower and closer to their path home, and much less oceanic than the Red Sea. Also, remember this story was written about 2,700 years ago and set about 3,200 years ago. Bodies of water change over time. In 1867, a Nebraska island in the Missouri River became permanently connected to Missouri. Part of Nebraska has been in Missouri ever since. That was a lot more recent than the story of Exodus. Bodies of water change. Have you ever been to the Nebraska island in Missouri as a Kansas native?
Mm-mm. What's it called?
I forget. it's not Bible fact, so I didn't write down the name of it.
No, we should take a vacation there.
Yeah. It's like no one lives there. Like Iowa administrates this part of Nebraska that's in Missouri.
It's complicated.
This is a Bible podcast. So misconception number 5. The crossing of the Red Sea couldn't possibly have happened. I've read books by Richard Dawkins. I know everything now. So we've already established that we're not talking about the Red Sea. Since it has reeds, it's a lake. Which lake? The point, whichever. The point is, once you realize we're talking about a lake with plants growing in it and not part of the ocean, it's plausible. Part of it dried up and then undried at a convenient time for one army and an inconvenient time for another. Weather alters battles all the time, sometimes get inflated into stories about the will of the gods. The Mongols versus Japan, the Persians versus Sparta, the Battle of the Bulge, that time Notre Dame threw 26 passes in a hurricane, it happens. You can find people drawing up maps and weather tables and documenting weird weather history to make arguments for each of these little bodies of water as being the thing that the Israelite authors were referring to. Wind allegedly blew Lake Manzala dry in 1882, and oceanographers have been studying it ever since. The University of Colorado did a big thing in 2010. Wind blowing a marshy body of water dry for a period of time is what the Bible describes. People have also thrown around volcanoes and tsunamis as possible explanations. We've already talked about how the Bible's authors possibly at times refer to real weather events, like the Nile maybe was running red from Ethiopian soil. Maybe the plague of darkness was based on a real eclipse. Maybe several of the plagues are based on the real-life Icelandic volcano that really did cause famines all around the Mediterranean, all around Egypt, quite possibly during the reign of Ramesses III, which would have happened between the time Exodus was set and when it was written down. So if you're writing a story about bad things happening to Egypt, maybe you say, hey, Grandpa, what was that story your grandpa told you about everything going dark in Egypt and nobody having food? Cool, I'll include that in my story about that time we escaped from Egypt. So maybe it's, you know, a couple hundred years of just weird stuff getting crammed into one story. And people can even talk you into the Gulf of Suez being the place where the Red Sea crossing happened if you want. There's a 1992 study by oceanographers from FSU and the Hebrew University of Jerusalem that found you'd need like 44 mile per hour wind for like 10 hours to dry a mile out of it. I mean, as a person from Kansas, does that sound like a lot of wind for a long time? Does that sound completely implausible?
No. I mean, if when you think about like hurricane winds and everything, it's not even, it's way more than that. So I think that was pretty fascinating.
Once you look at what is actually in the story and you are not approaching this with the mind that like, if I debunk the Ten Commandments movie, then God isn't real. You know, once you step aside from like this all or nothing mindset, what is actually in the Bible could be a like not all that mythologized version of something that really happened.
Well, and also what we think about with the Bible and all of these great acts and everything like that came from the last few hundred years, whereas the Bible is far, far older than that.
What do you mean?
Like the images that we have of, say, the walls of water on either side. We're not looking to several thousand years ago or even a couple thousand years ago to find those images. Those are what people have created more recently.
Yeah, it's not like the Israelite authors gave us a graphic novel showing what they imagined
right,
walls of water
like
to be.
Christianity over the last couple hundred years has done this.
And Judaism and pop culture and everything else. But like, there's a million ways to take it. Like, maybe the story they intended really was the massive, epic, entire thing. Or maybe it's just a slightly exaggerated version of something kind of plausible that also has a God character. And now, to be clear, you know, anyone who says like this is all ridiculous, it didn't happen, God isn't real, all that, that's cool, man. You're completely welcome on this show as well. Your viewpoint is entirely valid. The evidence is certainly not against you. Which brings us to misconception number 6, that there is any possible way to know whether this happened. And yes, there are lots of people who think that we can definitely prove the crossing of the Red Sea happened. Facebook.com is a ready source for information like this.
You're hating on my people.
As a Facebook person. So if someone tells you there are chariot wheels at the bottom of the Red Sea and shows you photos, no. No, that's fake.
They wouldn't last that long anyway.
For one thing, they said the Red Sea and not a sea of reeds. For another, they either come from some fake news website or from, I'm excited to unveil this guy for...
People are going to love this guy.
Ron Wyatt, the king of Bible archaeology scammers. Ron Wyatt was a nurse from Nashville who decided to go find Noah's Ark.
A nurse.
Then spent the rest of his life walking around the Middle East and pointing at stuff and saying it was from the Bible. This man found the Garden of Eden.
He found
Sodom.
Wow.
He found the Ark of the Covenant. Not just Noah's Ark, but Noah's grave.
He found everything.
And a living drop of Jesus' blood, like annihilation. Blood that was doing stuff.
Do you know what year that was that he found that? Because I feel like I remember hearing
it. It was
about
within
that.
The last few decades.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
guy only died 20 years ago.
I feel like
ago.
It was like when I was a kid or something, or like Evie's age that I heard that. And I was like, wow, what?
Yeah.
Jurassic Park it.
We're going to clone Jesus. We're going to have Jesus Park. This is our best idea
well,
yet.
Well, that, we already have Jesus Park. It's in Kentucky.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, Ron Wyatt has been debunked by everybody from the Israel Antiquities Authority to Christian actual archaeologists to Answers in Genesis, which runs the Creation Museum in Kentucky.
We have been there.
Oh, man. So this place is amazing. There's one part about, like, yeah, you know, dragons are probably real.
No, it doesn't say probably. Dragons are real. Dragons are real, and dinosaurs and dragons get confused all the time, obviously.
And then I forget exactly what it was, but there's like a one plaque toward the end that acknowledges, like, sure, fine, evolution was probably real too.
But it doesn't tell you, it doesn't ever say that evolution is real. It says change over time.
Yeah, it's like this, it's like this very begrudging asterisk at the very end. Like on the other wall is like, dragons are real, and like you're distracted from that and you look over and there's a, I don't know if it's like, do you like legally have to have something that say like, sure, fine, it's, the it's, real story.
The whole museum is to try and get you on board with the Bible timeline of the earth only being a few thousand years old. And so everything is telling you, like, from erosion and like the Grand Canyon, how it could have been formed in this amount of time and all of that. And then it's also talking about dragons on the ark. So it's a very confusing place. At the we have a picture of our daughter riding a dinosaur there.
A triceratops.
Yes. It's wonderful.
Yeah, at Grand Canyon. I think that was put there by Satan to deceive us.
Possibly.
So, Ron Wyatt, yeah, man. He died 20 years ago and somebody's still making money off his DVDs. He's like a knockoff Indiana Jones.
We should sell them on a website.
He's like, is that Illinois Jones or Kentucky Jones? Or there's not really a knockoff of Indiana.
Indiana is the knockoff.
Yeah, Indiana's, what does second-rate Indiana look like?
Southern Indiana.
Let's see. Oh, the only believable thing Ron Wyatt ever said, he couldn't produce any of this Bible treasure he allegedly found because he said Jim and Tammy Faye Baker stole it all.
Wow.
If you tell me Jim and Tammy Faye Baker stole something, I'm like, all right, Ron Wyatt, you have said one true thing. So, can we know that the Red Sea crossing happened? Well, first we've established it wasn't the Red Sea. No, otherwise. Thank you. Interlude, Exodus 14:30. Israel sees the Egyptian corpses on the seashore. So the Israelites sing about it.
Our first song.
First song in the whole Bible, yeah. First line, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea.
That's my favorite line, and it's repeated multiple times.
This is the first worship hymn, all about what a badass psychopath God is. Because lo and behold, this weird, needy family God our ancestors used to worship. Holy cow, he likes us a lot, and holy cow, it is good that we are not the people he doesn't like. Because they are bobbing lifelessly in a river with their horses.
On the shore, too.
Maybe now the Israelites are whispering to each other. Legends some of them are hearing for the first time. Hey, did you know this God once nuked a city? Did you know that flood and the Babylonian travelers through Egypt are always talking about? Like, I think it was this God. And they're talking about this God who was discarded by the side of the road on Mount Sinai and rediscovered by Moses. So this song they're singing, the first song in the Bible, the song is all about love between these people and God, something God never really asked for to this point. Like, we, you know, if you're raised Christian, you're taught, like, love, love, love. God is love. Jesus is love. Love God with all your heart.
Love your neighbor.
Love your neighbor. Love, love, love. And there's more love later in the Hebrew Bible. But to this point, loving God? It's clear God is jealous and needy, and God needs Adam to be in the garden with him. And, you know, God likes Noah, and God wants Abraham to trust him. But love?
Yeah, maybe this is the turning point for God, too.
It's I think it's really noteworthy that it's like it's coming from people, the idea of love. And, you know, you can almost see like God's heart unhardening a little bit here, right? Like God has recruited and made deals and made vague rules and lashed out and sought sacrifice, but destroying the enemies of these people gets him love. And I almost wonder if he's thinking like, which is better, love or obedience, you know? And you kind of see that tension for the rest of the Hebrew Bible because he is in love with these people and endlessly frustrated with these people when they do not, you know, when they do not treat him as like an almighty deity.
Well, and this is the first time that he's basically has like this nation of people, this large mass of people who are trusting in him and following him, because before it's just these small groups of people. And so he's really seeing what that looks like on a grander scale.
Yeah, it's got to be a lot for God to take in. And, you know, we're taught that saying things like that is, oh, how dare you? But like, come on, the character of God to this point, what in the world has prepared him for this moment of thousands of people adoring him? Misconception number 7, and you'll see how this one lines up in a second, that Moses wrote the entire Torah. That is the traditional storyline version. We have talked about this, I think, 3 or 4 episodes so far. But here's how it applies here. Remember Genesis 1? the missing Babylonian sea monster from before creation. Exodus 15, in a way, it might be revealing why God didn't have to fight that chaos ocean monster, why it just got deleted. God tamed it, mastered it, weaponized it, and God was it all along. He just kind of forgot about that aspect for a few thousand years because, quote from the song, "At the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The floods stood up in a heap. The deeps congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy pursued. You blew with your wind. The sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you, Lord, among the gods?" And this is all sounding very primordial and massively powerful in light of all we did was walk through a marsh full of reeds, man. And you're giving me this thing that sounds like it's, you know, it happened at the beginning of the world. And there's a pretty good reason for that, because most scholars taking a look at the ancient Hebrew wording of this song conclude that this might just be the oldest part of the Bible, written even closer to the Babylonian Canaanite chaos monster source material. In that light, the Song of the Sea of Exodus 15, it really sets the tone for the entire Bible's language. These like slightly aloof exclamations about an omnipotent being who will obliterate those who oppose his people, and we sure do love that about him. If someone asked you for like the definitive biblical text, you might pick the Song of the Sea, which was written, very likely, by someone who predated even story version Moses. Exodus 15:12, from the Song of the Sea, "You stretched out your hand," they sing to God, "and the earth swallowed them up." It was literally Moses who stretched out a hand over the water. This is not the last time Moses is referred to in a way that makes it clear he's almost an embodiment of God in the Israelites' mind. And we'll also see God thinks of Moses as the embodiment of the Israelites. He is very much a go-between.
He's the preacher.
He is. Actually, let's get right to that. So the song concludes with Moses and Aaron's sister Miriam, the one who started all of this by suggesting Moses' mom be hired as his Egyptian nanny. Miriam is called a prophet, which we will see later how Moses has earned that term by being a conduit between God and humanity. This title is awarded in a passage that shows her drumming and singing, leading the women. Daughters of Miriam, the book by Wilda Gaffney, shows how ancient Hebrew religion, much like many other Middle Eastern religions, was totally comfortable with the idea of women as prophets, with music and singing and dancing and charismatic frenzy considered legitimate prophecy.
This is my kind of Bible.
And women later also assisting in the big serious writer business we think of as prophecy. And then male nerd writers, the guys ultimately in charge of the Bible text, and the mostly male nerd writers who followed them have made us think prophecy means sitting around on a mountain with a big gray male beard and making spreadsheets about the Antichrist. But Miriam showed prophecy, all it means is expressing the divine via a human body in real time. She does it with music. Exodus 14:24, right before the Song of the Sea, shows the Israelites crossing the sea in the morning watch, meaning maybe sometime around 2 a.m., without the pillar of God fire to lead the way, because God's behind them holding off the Egyptians. They're walking through the pitch black of night through what was water. How do they see? How do they know which way to go? How do they avoid just walking into this wall of water? Were they following sound? Were they following music? Was it the music of Miriam? Did Miriam drum her way through the darkness with a nation behind her? And is that how she became a prophet? Along with, you know, delivering the deliverer in the very beginning of Exodus. Also, I like how the Song of the Sea, they keep singing about how everybody will hear about this and just be super terrified, even the Philistines that we're like avoiding, and that's why we came this route anyway. like they're singing about, oh man, just wait till those folks hear it. And like it is clear that like even though the Song of the Sea, the original text is very, 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 very old, possibly as old as, you know, older than parts of Genesis, older than anything, it still was adapted and fitted into this story. They did sort of tweak parts of it to fit the surrounding story and vice versa. Biblical scholar Carol Myers thinks the language in the poem is, it's more about God's general power, like his general power scale, as opposed to like literally describing just this story. And she describes it as almost being like retrofitted.
Well, and that would make sense too with it being God's hand, because by God's hand, a lot of things happen in the Bible, not maybe through other people like Moses for sure, but it's still God doing the work.
Yeah, that's a good point, because like if we're not just talking about just this story, you know, God's hand is guiding the entire journey of the Israelites, you know, even before they were Israelites, right? Guided Noah through the flood. So it's not just about the Red Sea.
Right.
Misconception number 8, you know, we've talked about whether it happened or not. I think misconception number 8 would be it matters if it happened. There could be a version of this story that really happened. Every word of it could be made up. It could all be in the middle. And we'll never know. Okay. here's the big one for me. Misconception number 9. The Bible's authors, definitely thought it happened. This one, I think, comes from, you know, growing up evangelical, being told it definitely happened, going to college and pivoting to an entirely different worldview, which is that all of it is fake. And like sort of reconciling all of that into a point where it's like, listen, it's a book. Okay. And here's what I think. In the Bible, we see mythology presented as if it is mythology, Babylonian mythology satirized, Canaanite mythology hijacked, Egyptian mythology mocked. We see poetic imagery, song lyrics, fables presented as if they are fables, rhetorical arguments, ironic jokes, sarcasm, drama, a woman described as looking like a sack of wheat as if that is attractive. We see nightmare visions, overlapping stories by multiple authors, lies presented as lies, unreliable narrators, and moments that would be referred to as magic realism if a modern author did them. All of these things are overlapping and collecting. We have every genre all at once. So why are we so certain the Bible's authors thought all their stories should be taken literally if they have all this stuff in there? Why do we assume the possibly dozens of people over the course of hundreds of years who wrote the Red Sea story were all trying to convince us it really happened exactly as described in the final version? Why is modern science the standard for people who never said they were writing a book of science? Why do we read a story of Greek or Roman or Scandinavian or Celtic mythology and think, oh, clearly this was all just meant to be a story. It was written by literary geniuses who knew animals can't talk. But we read a Middle Eastern story and we laugh about something that sounds scientifically unlikely. Why do ancient Europeans get a benefit of the doubt that they were just being literary? Why do we hold these nomadic desert authors to a higher standard than the people we're holding up as, like, you know, the pillars of classical society? Why can't we say that the authors of the Bible are using literary devices and tropes just like any other writer? That it's okay if they're making stuff up. They knew they were making stuff up. That doesn't mean all of it is made up. If we're happy to concede Jesus, a poor Jewish man from thousands of years ago, who spoke in made-up stories that he used intentionally to convey sophisticated meaning, and we're happy to admit it doesn't matter whether Jesus' story of the Good Samaritan really happened or not, then why do we fail to extend that same respect to the authors Jesus studied as a child and quoted as an adult? If it sounds made up to us, it would have sounded made up to them as well. They knew the area, culture, politics, history, weather, and literary influences better than we do. So if a story of 25,000 proto-Israelites sneaking across a depleted marsh morphed into a story of a volcano god blasting a path through the oceans for 2.5 million Israelites, that means the authors decided to do that for literary effect, for national prestige, whatever. Not to trick us, but for a whole bunch of reasons. Like, maybe they just wanted a really cool story. Yeah. And that's okay, too.
It's also very old, so a lot was lost in translation and a lot was left out that we don't get to see.
And I think part of the confusion is that the Bible's legends occur right alongside and within a big pile of stuff presented as hard history. And it's hard to tell them apart, but, like, it's actually not that hard. I think it's pretty easy to see that, like, hey, there might have been some history here.
It's been exaggerated maybe in some areas.
And it's okay either way.
But things still happen like that today, so...
So, like, part of the reason this frustrates me, you know, is the environment that we were raised in, where, like, you have to believe every word of it or no words of it. And so, like, part of the joke here, I realize, when you make fun of the Bible, you're not making fun of the authors necessarily. Maybe you're not making fun of the hundreds of millions of believers who don't take every word literally. You're probably making fun of the American evangelicals to try to convince you that you have to take all of it exactly as it's written or else. But who cares what they think? Why would we let a bunch of American evangelicals who were trying to make something as boring as possible ruin it for the rest of us? The Bible is awesome. Don't let people who try to beat you over the head with it ruin it for you.
American evangelicals have a very specific way of believing the Bible and the traditions that they want to carry on and uphold. And so they have twisted the Bible to fit what they want it to do.
Yeah.
Just like anyone else reading anything else could do.
Like, maybe the Bible's just not for you, and you only like our podcast. And, like, cool, that's fine. Please stay subscribed. But, like...
Thank you.
If you've ever had this idea that the Bible's not for you because of how you see American evangelicals and, you know, other hardcore folks twisting it and forcing you to take it all seriously, then the person who loses if you don't see what there is to gain from the Bible, you're not costing these evangelicals anything. You're costing yourself, you know, a look at an incredible work of literature. You know, whether this is the foundation of your religion or your worldview or your morality or, you know, any of that. And if nothing else, it's an amazing book. Because whether or not you agree that something within the bounds of the story could have possibly happened, Once you accept the authors quite possibly knew they were inventing a story, that's when you start to realize some really wild stuff could be going on. So please, credit the Bible's Middle Eastern authors with a level of literary sophistication, the same you would give when you read a story by white people about Thor wrestling a snake the size of Earth, or Athena being born from Zeus's skull. Just because people say stupid things about the Bible doesn't mean the Bible's authors were stupid.
Well, and you can see that too when you go back and read, and like we talked earlier on in one of the episodes about Sodom and how that was like the original basis of being gay being bad, but the Bible never actually says that. And so if you're taking your views of Christianity or views of religion in the Bible based on what evangelicals are out there preaching, that's not necessarily what you'll get out of it if you invest into it.
Yeah, and I think that's what we found every episode, is like, what is in there, and the stuff that is behind what is in there is so much better than what you get if you just listen to people tell you what is in there.
Right.
Except for us, because we're trying very hard.
There are people out there who are, I'll say, pastors or preaching the Bible, and who do have views more similar to ours, and Jason and I, even within the two of us, have different views, and that's okay. But I think that there is definitely something for everyone in the Bible, whether you're viewing it as a religion or not.
And sure, you know, to be clear, like when we say like a lot of people twist it, like there is a ton of incredible stuff on the Bible as a work of literature, as a work of mythology, as a foundation of pop culture, like a ton. Like we have learned so much. I have a stack of books, and I'm actually
keeps buying more and more books. They're coming like by the truckload.
Just got Robert Alter's gigantic Hebrew Bible translation. Just got that book by Wilda Gaff. You know, so much incredible work is out there about the Bible. Don't let stupid people ruin it for you. Misconception number 10 about the Red Sea. It's just a story about some people walking across dirt. Okay, so you could talk theology about the story all day. You can make it about Jesus going to the ground and coming back out. You could look at 3,000 years of Jewish theology for like all sorts of deep meanings. On this show, at least I like to always find some sort of harebrained ancient mythological influence for the story that ended up in the Bible.
This is like one of his favorite things, though, even with like pop culture movies or the Marvel Universe. It doesn't matter. This is like what he enjoys doing.
I'm reading about the Thor today. About
See?
Norse mythology. So if the plagues, as we discussed in the Moses episode, were about the God of the Israelites consuming the power of the Egyptian gods, absorbing fragmented all-father power back into the source, if the plague of the Nile was about humbling Egypt's river gods and the parting of the Sea of Reeds is the final plague, then let's note this. The Lake of Tanis, proposed by a University of Colorado professor as a potential place where a sea crossing kind of like Exodus's could have worked, it was only rediscovered in 2009. Egypt's culture ministry described it as a sacred lake, but it had since gone dry and been buried and forgotten to time. This lake was sacred because it was connected to a temple of Mut, one of the most ancient Egyptian gods and something of a queen mother god. So if each plague is about the god of the Israelites defeating a specific Egyptian god, the final plagues would be darkness, defeating the sun god Ra, who by this time would have been realized as Amun-Ra, not just sun god, but Egypt's all-father. Plague of the firstborn, snuffing out the next demigod. The plague of the sea, defeating not just the current demigod Pharaoh, but also the queen mother god and the wife of Egypt's original creator god. So it's possible the Red Sea, if it's a plague, it's possible it was also meant to mock a specific Egyptian god.
Which is kind of what some of the other plagues lend themselves toward as well, like the plague of the frogs.
Take that, frog god. Exodus 15:10-11, again from the Song of the Sea. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you among the gods, O Lord? This passage is likely more than 3,000 years old, possibly hundreds of years older than the surrounding text. When the Song of the Sea was written, polytheism might have been even less controversial than it was until a monotheist got a hold of all this text and kind of...
I mean, and that could have even been a reference to, like, the flood and Noah and all those people.
Mm-hmm, quite possibly. I mean, I think the Song of the Sea, to me, just considering its age, it's really easy to wonder if there were, you know, if there was a group of Hebrews at some point who this was their creation story, the Song of the Sea. If you have Genesis 1 is a creation story, a self-contained start to finish. Genesis 1 could be the entire Bible. You could end the Bible at the end of Genesis 1. It's a self-contained story. Genesis 2 starts a different creation story with a different word for God. It's zoomed in. It's kind of part of the same story, but it's a different perspective. The Song of the Sea in Exodus, it could be an entirely different perspective on the creation of the world from the chaos waters. And here it is in a whole different book. And a lot of this will later be referenced in Psalms and Isaiah and Jeremiah. The same things just kind of keep echoing and echoing all throughout. Let's bring it home real quick. Exodus 16 through 18. The Israelites are marching for days and days through the wilderness with nothing to drink or eat. So God keeps fixing this via magic, and he's getting sick of their griping and needing to eat. It's like he's just gotten pets and he doesn't know how to take care of them.
He has a bunch of whiny toddlers after a long day at the zoo.
Well, it's like, did you not know you'd need to feed them? Like, just because you're God and you don't need to eat.
Jesus was not around yet.
Jesus wasn't around him. Just dump baskets of fish everywhere.
Right.
That probably is like when God was like sending Jesus down. And we don't need to get into like, oh, was Jesus around at the time of Exodus or not? Because then we'll be excommunicated by the Pope of the year 1025, I think is when that happened. Huh. You know, when God was giving Jesus his powers, like one of the first ones he said was like, okay, these people eat a lot. You're going to need to be
They're going to need some food.
If you don't make food, they are going to gripe your ear off. Son. So this magic food is where the quote manna from heaven comes from. God is just like sprinkling this like magic space dandruff on the desert, and they pick it up and they eat it. And you could do a whole episode about what this food was. One theory is it's like sugary secretions from desert aphids, which, I mean, it sounds gross, but it's kind of like honey, right? Bugs make honey. But anyway, it's like this sweet, it's raining frosted flakes. Not so bad. There's also like free flocks of quail everywhere, sure. And God is being this like cranky, turn this bus around dad, but literally this is basic logistics. So after, you know, like more than a month of wandering and so little progress and with such paycheck to paycheck supplies, God and Moses and the people are all really sick of each other. And like, you know, sure, God's never led a crowd of more than 70 humans before this, and that was hundreds of years ago. He did lead 20 million animals to a boat he designed, and he did create 500 billion galaxies in the observable universe, and he did murder the primordial chaos monster in a battle too hot for Genesis, but, like, packing lunchboxes is too challenging. But
I mean, they wouldn't have been able to carry all that food anyway.
God's been rusty. It's fine. It's fine, big guy. Also, we have no idea where this is at. Somewhere on the Sinai Peninsula near the very special mountain. And like, you know, they do pass landmarks at points, but like in generally, it's, I don't know where they are. So they're about to riot because they're stuck in the desert with no water, which like, yes, if you stick me in the desert with no water, I will riot. Moses is afraid they're going to stone him. God tells Moses to use his magic snake water staff to hit a rock and make water out of it. And it works. Hooray. And then out of friggin' nowhere, the Israelites are attacked by the Amalekites.
Oh, boy.
Who? There's people out here?
Yeah, this part is, it just kind of, oh, hello.
Yeah, and there is a setup. Like, it does matter later on. These guys are some descendants of Esau's, and that's, like, all we need to know about them for now. Moses realizes his army needs a general, and he installs some guy named Joshua. Joshua defeats the Amalekites.
Oh, Joshua.
Yeah, Joshua. Important name. Let's remember him. This is Israel's first act of war. Up until now, all they've done is walk and God fix it for them. Here, Joshua defeated the Amalekites. Again, Moses uses his magic snake, water, rock, staff. As long as he's holding up, the Israelites fight war real good. They win. God says, I will utterly blot out the remembrance of the Amalekites. But unfortunately, he said that in the most popular book of all time. So now the Amalekites are like a billion times more memorable than they would have been if he had just told them to leave this whole story out.
Even though it's a very small section even.
But still, the Amalekites have a Wikipedia page, and they would not if God hadn't said that he will blot them out. But like, I don't, maybe change their name, you know?
Darn you, Wikipedia.
Maybe he changed the name to protect the guilty. Exodus 18. Moses and Zipporah. Moses' wife. Maybe they get some kind of divorce here?
This part is really weird.
Yeah. Like, a lot of people have argued about what this means for a long time.
Zipporah is sent to be back with her dad and their kids.
Yeah, Moses sends Zipporah back to Jethro, and like, maybe it's divorce. Maybe she had no idea what marrying him meant getting into. We've done God battles and liberation wars and exoduses across the desert and people are trying to stone you. I'm going home.
She was tired.
And Moses is later described as married again, and that might be some other lady or it might be Zipporah again, but either way, Miriam doesn't like her. Get to that later. For now, Zipporah's gone. Exodus 18:11, Jethro, our wise old Obi-Wan hermit, the guy who first kind of told Moses about God on Mount Sinai, the burning bush episode, and Zipporah's dad, he hears about Egypt and the liberation. And this old mountain hermit priest who lived by the tiny fire god on Sinai way back when, Jethro says, now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. And Jethro would know, because this guy at the crossroads of this part of the world, he knows all the gods. He's met all the gods. He's heard about all of them. But he's never heard about a god like this. Finally, Moses explains to his wily mountain hermit father-in-law, Jethro, that Moses is sitting around all day arbitrating disputes among the Israelites by asking God what to do about each one. Moses is a judge and a pope and a sheriff, and Moses has every job.
Right. He hasn't delegated anything out at this point.
Jethro's like, so listen, my dear son-in-law, who just divorced my daughter.
Or maybe it was just like Zipporah was too famous because she was Moses' wife and she needed a break from signing autographs. So she went to live back with her dad.
So Jethro's like, listen, your job sucks. So why don't you like hire some helper judges and you can teach them all these rules that God has given you. And then you can just be the Supreme Court. And Moses is like, that is very cool. But, and I will do that, you know, and I will install these people to help me, and we will set up a whole org chart. But you said rules.
What are those?
Next time on the Vacation Bible School podcast, we will discuss rules. Yeah. Because for the we are finally getting terms and conditions. Anarchy is over. If you would like to support this podcast, you can rate and review us on the app of your choice. You can follow us at VBS Podcast on Twitter and or Instagram. You can subscribe to our newsletter at jasonkirk.substack.com. And you can go to our Ko-Fi page, supportvbs.com, where monthly donors will be getting Vacation Bible School stickers and hopefully other bonuses to come. This is our shortest episode yet.
Oh, good job. You didn't talk so much. I mean, you did. Maybe you just spoke faster.